Would you introduce yourselves, please?
Sure. I'm Finn. I'm the lead singer and guitarist of Fink.
I'm Tim. I'm the lead drummer and guitarist also of Fink.
Dance music. Let's see. You lied to your record label. We're going to get to that one. That's a well-told tale. We're going to do that. 2006, blah, blah, blah. Would you each tell me something that is really going to inform people about this band? And you have the option of lying.
We play music on guitars, bass, and drums that we try and make sound like dance tracks. So they have build-ups, they have hypnotic bits, they have kind of, they get you into a certain mood. That's what I think is happening right now in our band. Layers.
Yes, dance music is part of the past for us, but not many, many people. Obviously, it's still very much part of their present. But one of the great things about rock and roll is that you get to reference, you know, everybody else that's done it before you. And in a way with dance music, when I started making that, you couldn't do that. You had no one to reference. So that's actually quite, like, that informs our band, the fact we can reference people from 40 years ago. But when I was in dance music, you couldn't reference anybody from last month. It was already out of date, old, unfashionable, and it was all about the now, whereas rock and roll is a bit more about the then and now.
When you come right down to it, the 90s was the right time to be in dance music, and you've said that. But what's fascinating to me is that most people would say, oh, no, now is the time because of EDM. But when you said that the 90s was a great time, tell me about that, because that you were bucking the trend. You were how many years, you know, before the quote trend? And I don't believe there ever was a trend.
Well, it depends. It depends. So there's a loaded gun right to my head right there. Yeah, 90s. You know, all I'm going to say on all that stuff is that dance music's great when you're in your 20s. There you go. And I was in my 20s in the 90s. So it's moved on. It's all different now. And the niches have developed and the genres have developed, and it's all become very, not corporate, but just, you know, grown up. And it's less sort of hedonistic. It's just like rock in a way, you know. It's less hedonistic and less kind of, you don't get crusty tribal hippies mixing with, you know, hedge fund kids and suburban kids in outdoor raves anymore. You get, they all have their own niche, their own club, their own bar, their own coffee house, and so on and so on. So, you know, I live in Berlin now, and it's really given me back my love of electronica, as has Tom York and his electronica records. I mean, they're really exciting. I really love the Atoms for Peace record. I love the Eraser record. So he's kind of owning it. He's EDM, in my opinion. You know, I think, and I say this to my Berlin minimal guys all the time. EDM is just a new way of saying it's not specifically designed to be played at 4 a.m. in a nightclub. It's the same music. It's just designed for everyday use, but you can't call it everyday use house because it doesn't roll off the tongue very well. and anyway, the EDM used to be IDM, used to be brain dance, used to be, you know, and then it just go back and back. And what was Tangerine Dream then? What do you think they were?
Well, they were progressive.
So they progressive electronica.
Yes, I would say so, definitely, but more prog than. Kraftwerk were more electronic than prog, and Tangerine Dream were more prog than electronic, I would say. Tangerine Dream were closer to Can, perhaps?
Perhaps.
In vibe and kind of, you know.
And for those still listening, this is Fink talking genres.
Yes.
But I do agree with you about that.
Right. Yeah, the interesting thing about people saying that was a good time to be in dance music into the 90s was that it was also a good time to be in guitar music. That's the weird thing. So I suppose, and it was almost too good, like Britpop happened and it was too much guitar music. And I suppose being into electronic and dance music at that time, you were bucking the trend. You were being consciously different to what everyone else was doing, because in guitar music, there was no independent, there was no indie, there was no alternative, because the alternative was the mainstream.
Yeah, I mean that's the it was very trendy dance music in the 90s. That's why I got into it. It was super trendy and super underground, and that's the kind of guy that I was, a super trendy guy. But it meant that we had very separate 90s, didn't we? We had totally separate 90s.
Totally. And those 90s occasionally met in a horrible club on a council estate in King's Cross, where I was playing with Guy, the current bass player of Fink, in an indie band. And Finn arrived and he used to say, "Why are you doing this? Why would you want to do this in a horrible carpeted club? Yeah, I'm wearing brand new trainers and they're going to get all horrible and scuffed up."
It's true. I mean, my footwear cost more than your fee that night. And it was just like, dude, why do you guys do this? But now, of course, I totally get it. Yeah, I mean, this doing something on your own, it can get a bit lonely. I mean, dance music's full of loner control freaks, and I was definitely one of those in my 20s, an absolute loner control freak. But band is a totally different dynamic. You've got to share your own space, you've got to share the money, you've got to share the ideas and the creativity, and there's no compromise when you're an electronic guy. It's just you. But there's loads of good artistic compromises in a band.
Boy, do I have a great segue here. Watch this. By the way, hello audience, we're going to skip the How He Fooled Ninja Tune into being a solo artist. You can read that part. Sure. We're going to skip that story because I think everybody can read that story over and over again. However, look at this quote after what you just said. "The most unique piece of equipment you can have in the studio is yourself. When I'm at a club and I see somebody 21 years old and there's no records on the turntables and I know what they're using on their computer, I say the Segways have no soul."
Well, I'd like to comment on that by saying that a lot of the younger DJs that I bump into in Berlin these days are actually reverting back to vinyl and doing combi sets.
Real vinyl, though, not vinyl combined.
No, just their records, you know, because they've listened to a track in a club, gone up to the DJ and gone, "God, that sounds amazing, what's that?" And it's like, it's on vinyl. They don't want the whole set to be on vinyl because it's exhausting.
Yes.
But they don't want to go vinyl to vinyl because it's scary. But they love going vinyl out of CDJ or CDJ out of vinyl. And it's interesting because they don't want to take a record bag to the gig. They want to take a couple of USB keys. But I've seen it and I've heard it, and it's really interesting. What the younger DJs are doing now is they're combining all the tech, CDJs, Ableton, and vinyl, and all this trigger stuff that the corporations are making, you know, the plastic little boxes. Levan, he was using the best tech he had. He was splicing lock grooves with tape, and then the rap guys were pressing acetates and using MPC 2000s, and the dance guys were using 303s and 909s. So we all use the top tech that we've got. Right. But it is a bit soulless to see a guy playing solitaire on his laptop for 3 hours in a nightclub. It's too perfect.
So looking too closely is an example about the music being all about the being alone in some ways, and then taking that aloneness and bringing it to a band, is it not?
Yeah, it's definitely about, it's a conversation with yourself, which is definitely a very one-on-one conversation. And I'm getting better at expressing those conversations in song. Like at the beginning of it all, it was all just therapy for myself. And now it's more of a cerebral exercise. And songwriting is about having a personal conversation with yourself and being honest with yourself. It's not the easiest thing to do, to be honest. But the more you do it, the better you get at it. And just like you're the most original piece of equipment in your studio, the same with songwriting. Your personal experiences are the unique things that are unique to you. That's when other people will feel it. But everybody goes through the same stuff, same teenage angst. You never shake it off, I don't think, as a dude. You carry it around with you forever.
17 days to produce a pretty fancy record, you know, in a fancy schmancy Hollywood studio. But when I listen to this...
Well, you think it sounds like it was made in a bedroom?
No. That's the whole point, is it's got all the density, it's got all the stuff, and we'll talk about some of the fun things you did. But it really is clean. It sounds like you put on a reel of tape and you recorded it. And even though it's got a lot of layers and a lot of stuff, overall, it sounds super, super pretty and super clean. Now, is that one of my favorite things to talk about, and my audience knows, is the producer-artist relationship. I do that in the full announcer voice, the producer-artist relationship. So when you come upon a guy like Billy Bush, a guy who is most definitely, you know, a legendary guy, and you go to a legendary studio, and you are this band, and you have a point of view, tell me where the ends met and where the ends didn't meet, and what you walked in with before. How formed was this? I'm asking 12 questions at once, which is going to lead to a narrative between the two of you. How fully formed was this puppy before you go in with someone of this caliber into a studio of that caliber and do it in 17 days?
It was, I think, 80% formed.
That's what I suspected.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of the nuts and bolts were in there of, I would say, 80%. And then we were allowed, because it was our second record with Billy, we were used to him. We had that whole process of not having to get to know him, and him not having to get to know us, which was great. And he's very good at just letting us get on with it. And he's also got a ton of gear, musical equipment, and there's stuff there. And we just sort of did the other 80% while we were there.
So we did 160%?
No, sorry, 20, the other 20%.
You're handling the money on this.
I know, terrible, isn't it? But yeah, I know, exactly. But we did the other 20% while we were there. But we also wrote a couple of songs while we were there too. But we just loved it. I mean, that's the thing. We didn't mess around at all. I mean, it sounds the way it does because we did nothing else for 3 weeks but go to the studio and record. We barely had a beer, you know. We didn't do anything else. We didn't go anywhere else. We didn't have a day off.
We had many beers night.
But we
didn't really feel like it.
But I mean, we're not like the sort of band who drinks in the studio to kind of get a vibe. And we were all there the whole time. The three of us was there the whole time. I know everyone works their, you know, butts off in life, but we really worked during that time and to make it as good as possible.
I mean, one of the great things about Billy is that he enables us to do it at that speed, which enables us to capture the moment, but not shoddily, if you know what I mean. And we did Perfect Darkness in 16 days, I think, didn't we? And which is the previous record. And he didn't think we were going to get it done, but he took the gig anyway. He was like, oh, it's in between this gig and that gig, you know, so I'll do this quick record. They think they're going to do it in 16 days. They better be rehearsed. And luckily, we were totally red hot rehearsed. We'd already toured it. We were good to go. And this one, he said, oh, great. Have we got longer this time? We're like, yeah, bro, we got loads longer. We got a day extra. So you can have a day off. And he took Sundays off too, which is fair. So. Well, because we didn't have to go through getting to know you stage again with Billy, we could just arrive on day one, and we were tracking day two, no question. And when he had his days off, that's when we'd tidy up the bits and pieces, write new stuff, fix that bridge, tweak that chorus, whatever needed to happen. We were wide awake and 100% on point for it.
And when he left for his day off, he said to us, "Whatever you do, don't record a dub instrumental track." And we came back and we'd recorded White Flag. We didn't disobey him on purpose, but yeah, that's why. Yeah.
Sure. But all the toys, Ebo on piano, upgrading grand pianos, double drums. And my favorite part that I dug up, cheap brushes.
Oh, very cheap.
Using the cheapest brushes to get just that sound. So you had toys in the studio, but then how did you get creative with the rest of it? Because if you have a set of toys, you know, you kind of say, oh, we got these toys, we'll just use them. But you didn't only get the toys, you messed up the room.
Yeah, we did. We see the room as like an instrument in itself. And we played a room, definitely.
You know, a sandbox.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It was fantastic. And What the way we do it is we go in, we set the room up on the first day, get everybody in a great space, and then we just go hell for leather until literally check in and flying home.
Yeah.
And in Sound Factory, the great thing was it's been around for so long and there's so many legendary records made in this place that it's not going to be the studio's fault if your record's crap. It's going to be you. You know, the producer's world famous and really awesome, and the studio's world famous and really awesome. So if you make a duff, then it's definitely you. And that raises your game too. Every take really does. And Billy's amazing because he's a total habit form tech geek. He's a collector. He's a hoarder. He's got every mic you could have, and he's got every synth you could want. He's got every guitar you could need. He's got bass, drums. He's got a problem, which is good for us. Because when he says, "Oh, I need to get my stuff delivered to the studio," when we did Perfect Darkness, it was two lorries of stuff. It was wow. Car. It was proper. We showed up with a couple of guitars. He showed up with like two.
Yeah, but you showed up with a 1981 Martin.
That's beautiful. That one.
I
yeah.
mean, you showed up with some pretty.
The 1981 D35. That was the last flight it will ever take. That the recording session was the last time I'm going to risk
man.
It. Yeah, I was brave. But when I got it home, it hasn't left the apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a real shame because I have an apartment in Berlin, and that lives in my Brighton home, and I can't transport it over because I'd have to fly. Mm. So yeah, I need to. I'm going to buy a seat. I think buy an EasyJet seat. I don't know if EasyJet allow you to do that, but just buy. Yeah, buy a seat next to me and put the guitar in there.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And it's two of your songs as the bread, and then anybody else you want to play in between. And we have 40 minutes of music to fill.